we've learned anything from these past couple of years, my fellow Americans, it's that personal medical freedom and liberty are in crisis. America Out Loud Pulse brings together the top experts in healthcare-related fields to keep you a beat ahead.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Glenn Jung from Bright Light News, and I have the honor of being here with Professor Emeritus of Epidemiology, Dr. Harvey Risch. Thanks so much for being here today.
That's my pleasure to be with you.
Excellent. So we're sitting here in the EU Parliament. The International COVID Summit number 3 just finished. It was a fantastic day with 31 international experts speaking today. What was it that you spoke about today that the world needed to hear?
Well, it's interesting that I actually spoke about something that is not my central area of expertise, but something that I have followed and covered, which is the waning efficacy of the vaccines. So we've had these COVID vaccines now for a little over 2 years, almost 2.5, and there's been great turmoil over them from the beginning, that they were held up as going to save the world from the pandemic. Most people uncritically bought into that idea. What they found is that they were told, oh, well, we don't expect them to work for 2 weeks, so if you get COVID within 2 weeks of getting vaccinated, you were unvaccinated during that time, which, of course, that would drive me crazy because I know the science and I know you don't do that, but people kind of fell for that. And then after that, it did likely reduce the risk of getting COVID for a while. And then what happened is, over more time, the vaccines started to lose their efficacy for two reasons. One is that they kind of clobbered the immune system, and the immune system, after a while, wakes up more toward its normal functioning. And at the same time, the virus continues to evolve, to change, to mutate, to form new strains and substrains that are less keyed to the specifics of the vaccine. And until the vaccine changes, until we got, for example, the bivalent booster, which was DOA when it arrived, the efficacy wanes over time. And in fact, it did that. And so we saw that over some 8 to 10 weeks after the second dose of the two Moderna and Pfizer vaccines, the efficacy started to go south. Eventually, after another 3 or 4 weeks, it came close to zero, and over a longer time frame, went negative efficacy, which means that at that point, people who were vaccinated had a higher risk of getting COVID than unvaccinated people from the whole beginning. And then the boosters came out, and people kind of got psyched up again to the degree that they thought, okay, well, why would I expect the vaccines to work for more than 6 months? So now I'll take a new one, another booster to boost, right? And so they did, and now it worked, you know, again, the same 2 week pause, and then it started working again for now for like maybe 5 to 6 weeks, and going south, again, on the verge of going negative. And that's been the pattern. Each time another dose of the vaccine was taken, the window of when it reduces the risk of getting infected shortens. And that's been the pattern. It's a dynamic effect of the vaccines. It's not a static one where you get X benefit and it stays forever. It doesn't. It goes up, comes down, and goes to either zero or below zero over a long enough time. And people have started realizing that. And so this is what I presented, the information about that, that the empirical data. I'm an epidemiologist. So when I do science, I love theories. Most of my research has been on cancer research, cancer etiology. And so I have theories that I make about how cancers form, what are the risk factors, why the risk factors, and so on. Do I believe those theories? No. I love them, but I don't believe them. I do empirical studies to try to support or refute those theories. And the theories that survive my empirical studies then take on more credibility. And some of them have done that and some haven't. So I'm very empirical, and that's how I view both the ideas about vaccination and about my cancer research as well.
Right, and this, as you said, this is the basis of science. You have a hypothesis, and you either have something to refute it or support it, and that way you move forward, and it's a truth, it's a temporal thing until some other piece of evidence may come along to refute or support it. For people who took the vaccine believing that it would protect them from getting sick because they were told by the Faucis and everybody else. How do you think they justify in themselves when they actually get sick the booster period? What I'm really looking at is that 2-week period you talked about is so important in the studies. Actually, you mentioned during your speech today that they never actually took you as a vaccinated person until that 2 weeks. Talk about how that manipulation of data got these drugs through the regulatory process.
So one of the key factors of the whole pandemic has been the misrepresentation of plausibility as if it were science. We've been told to believe lots of things that seem plausible, but it turns out they're not true. And the issue about the 2-week pause or latency is, suppose you give somebody a drug, but you know it takes 2 weeks before it starts working. Okay? So you don't expect it to work in the 2 weeks because whatever, it has to build up, it has to start working, it has to grow, whatever its biological mechanism is. So the vaccinologists and the public health people said the same applies to the vaccines. It takes 2 weeks before they start working. Okay, so if you're talking about efficacy, that might be true, but the problem is that they conflate adverse events with getting COVID. So the vaccine's efficacy is supposed to reduce the risk of getting COVID. But in the first 2 weeks, if you get COVID, it's an adverse event. But it's the same adverse event or failure of the vaccine, depending on which period before the 2 weeks or after you're in. And that conflation made the representation that that doesn't count false. So if you get COVID, it has to count from when you got in your car to decide to get vaccinated. That's when it counts. When you did, you put the plan to get vaccinated into action because you made a choice to do a behavior that led to something that ultimately either helped you with regard to COVID or didn't help you. And so I'm a little bit facetious about that. You could say it started when you actually got injected. I'm fine with that. But it starts then as to whether you get COVID or not. So these vaccines, if they increase your risk 1,000-fold of getting COVID in the first 2 weeks, that's an exaggeration. But let's say you would say if you got COVID in the first 2 weeks, well, of course, that's an adverse effect of the vaccines because they really wreck your immunity for 2 weeks, right? But they raise it, but not 1,000-fold. But the idea is that that is part of what you get when you get vaccinated. And so it should have counted for the efficacy. But they smeared that by saying, oh, no, the vaccines didn't have a chance to work. And we're not calling that an adverse event. It is an adverse event. That's the whole problem. It's an adverse event that's the same as the negative outcome later on.
Right, and when you look at the VAERS data, at the actual deaths, you see the vast majority of the deaths were within the first 48 hours, I believe.
Well, so interestingly, in VAERS, almost all adverse events that are serious, death being one, peak on the day after vaccination. Or some on the first day, some the day after. For example, going into shock, what's called anaphylaxis, peaks on the same day. Some of the others peak the next day. Death peaks, I think, the next day. And then they taper off. Now, you have to realize VAERS is a reporting system, so people have to file a report, and right after you get vaccinated, everybody's focused on, oh my God, I got vaccinated, should I worry about it? And so if something bad happens, people are going to say, of course, it happened because of the vaccine, right? In the other vaccines, previous, influenza and so on, it's ho-hum, yawn. You know, did something bad happen? Yes. Was it from the vaccine? Well, I don't know. I mean, everybody takes influenza vaccines. How would I know, you know, even though it's the next day or 2 days later? Well, you know, the influenza vaccines don't cause people to die, so why should I worry? Why should I even file a report? So there's a lot more focus now because of the fear in the population that's been induced that any adverse event, a serious adverse event, is much more reportable. That's a problem with interpreting the excess of death. Do I believe that there are excess of deaths? Yes, of course, because those excess deaths continue day 3, day 4, day 5, day 7, day 10. You still see excess deaths that are reported for these vaccines. So there's still a lot there. But do I ascribe all of them to it? No, because there's also a focus, a much more intense focus now than there's been compared to previous vaccines.
Right. So if you're looking for something, you're going to find more of it. One of the interesting things that we never hear in the mainstream media is that with the excess deaths, if the vaccines had worked like they claimed, we should have seen the graph go down. But instead, we've seen an inverse trend line where it's going up in terms of excess deaths since the start of the pandemic, afterwards, after the release of the vaccines. But we should have seen it come down and stay down.
So what I think is interesting, I think that's right, but that's a theory, right? Empirically, what you see is a slight excess in deaths that, while it's not zero and it's real, and the VAERS data and the other databases that are reporting adverse events and mortality by COVID vaccination date and so on show the same thing, even if they're not made public, as far as I understand, that it's relatively small, that mortality from these vaccines in the initial time frame is still pretty small. If you're going to vaccinate 100 million people and you have 10,000 deaths or 1,000 deaths from that, you know, it's bad. We don't expect vaccines to kill healthy people. But on the other hand, it's a very small percentage of all the people who got vaccinated. So it's hard to see a signal there in a gross public health kind of way. Now, the flip side of that is the mortality, all-cause mortality, has grown over time. In, for example, in the 18 to 64-year-old group, which is your normal working adult age range, the insurance companies have seen excess deaths starting about the third quarter of 2021 going into 2022, I believe. That was about 6 to 12 months after the vaccines were rolled out. And what they were seeing was largely cardiovascular deaths, heart attacks, and related strokes and things like that. And so that's a more longer-term kind of mortality that one sees that you could not have predicted from the beginning, but it's real. And it wasn't just one insurance company, it was five U.S. insurance companies and a German insurance company, all saw the same thing, all continuing, excess mortality. But could you have figured out that you give the shots and 2 weeks later you see excess mortality? It's not that. But it's still something that's real. It did not happen in 2020 or 2019, so it's not COVID. In COVID, it would have been 2020. Didn't happen in 2020. Did happen in 2020, 2021, and 2022. So this is a what I'll call an intermediate kind of time frame, more excess mortality that one sees also that is part and parcel of the vaccine regimen that we didn't know whether we would see, and unfortunately we are seeing it. It's not huge, again, but it's still appreciable. And, of course, nobody bought into that risk. Everybody thought they were being a good citizen getting vaccinated to protect the country of all the people who got vaccinated. And nobody figured that they were putting themselves at appreciable risk for harm, which has turned out to be there, although, as I said, it's not common, but it's there.
So we see this manipulation of data, this omission of data. It's brought on a lot of mistrust within the public health institutions, now in the government. Talk to us, we'll come back to that, but I want to kind of follow a line also about early treatment. What can you tell us about the early treatment?
Early treatment was the linchpin of the pandemic. We knew at the outset of the pandemic, within a month or two, that hydroxychloroquine, particularly when used with antibiotics like azithromycin, doxycycline, and zinc, was an effective remedy for cutting risk of hospitalization and mortality in high-risk people. And we knew that it was in use. It was in use in, I think it was in use in Korea. In China, the Chinese government in March of 2020 put out a 30 or 40 page document on treating COVID in outpatients and hospital patients. In the outpatient section, it says to treat with chloroquine sulfate and gave the dose. That was their policy. They knew it worked. And we had doctors like Dr. Zev Zelenko in the US who was treating patients starting in late February of 2020 in his community in upstate New York, who were coming down with COVID left and right because it was a closed religious community. They were interacting with each other very closely, you know, for the holidays there. And so There was a lot of COVID, and he treated all the high risk people. He had no deaths. Then he had one in a person who got hydroxychloroquine too late. They came to him too late. Other than that, there were no deaths. There were two or three hospitalizations out of about 4,000 people that he treated in that community. So we knew, he knew, and we all knew that this was working. He went to President Trump, said, "President Trump, why don't you use this? Why don't you put this all out there?" Trump said, "This is great. It's going to help for the pandemic." Everybody said, anything that Trump says, we say the opposite. Trump can't be right. They politicized it, but this politicization was fake because it was already afoot to suppress outpatient treatment with hydroxychloroquine and other medications. And we knew this because in fall of 2019, the French Minister of Health changed the status of hydroxychloroquine from over-the-counter, it had been over-the-counter in France because it's such a safe, benign medication. People use it for malaria prevention and other reasons, but it was, you just buy it in the pharmacy without a prescription. She changed it to prescription only. And she revealed this in January 2020, but she made the policy in fall of 2019, knowing that this was coming. And before there were any cases that we knew, she knew, and she did this for a reason where she cited spurious evidence claiming that chloroquine was genotoxic. That means it has a genetic damage risk, which is not true. She knew it was not true, and she lied, and she made that comment, which was just absurd, and it has no relationship to hydroxychloroquine, which is a somewhat different drug than regular chloroquine, that's much safer even than regular chloroquine. And so all of this was afoot before anybody knew there in the real world that there was a pandemic coming. The pharma knew that there was a pandemic coming. And that's basically says that there is a kind of a captured world, or maybe we're the captured world, that they knew that this was happening. They had been involved in the whole process of this. They had been involved in the planning. There was a paper that was published in the New England Journal called "The Magic of Randomization Versus the Myth of Real-World Evidence." This was a screed against epidemiology. It's a total nonsense paper. Again, plausibility, a false plausibility paper that was published on February 13th of 2020. They must have written it in January. Nobody knew that this pandemic was coming except these four people who were all highly funded by pharma who wrote this paper. And so this was the background of early treatment. So we knew, they knew early treatment works, that we know now from 9 studies of hydroxychloroquine looking at hospitalization and mortality, that by itself it cuts the risk of death by 75%. And with these other medications like zinc and azithromycin, it cuts it even more. And that's why Zelenko was able to do so well in his community in New York, because the drug works really well. Well, think about it. This drug costs 40 cents a day. Okay, not $3,000 a day for Remdesivir, right? Or not $1,500 or $1,800 or whatever the vaccination dose is. Not $1,900 for Paxlovid. Okay, 40 or 80 cents a day for the dose, depending on what you take. And doxycycline is something along the same line, and zinc is a vitamin, it's 50 cents, 25 cents, whatever it is. You're treating it for less than a dollar a day times 5 or 7 days. You get the idea that this cripples the economic playing field for things that are expensive patent products, vaccines or other medications. Had to be suppressed at all costs. And that was the problem here, that had this medication and later ivermectin, which works pretty much as well, had they been available in this time frame, two things would have happened. Number one, there would have been hundreds of thousands of people who didn't die unnecessarily because they got treatment within the first 5 or 6 days and didn't die. Second thing is, people's fear would have been cut close to zero. They wouldn't have been malleable. And one of the byproducts of forcing people not to be treated and creating excess deaths during the first year before the vaccines came out is making people afraid and compliant with all of the control measures so that they would suck up the vaccines when the vaccines became available.
So the big question that comes to my mind is why you have a vaccine that's not safe or efficacious and the government promotes it. You have early treatments that work, that are cheap, that could help people.
And are completely safe.
Right.
Completely safe.
Right. And we saw in Africa a vast majority of the population took ivermectin. They had such a low vaccination rate and hardly any morbidity, mortality in those countries. Why are we seeing this from public health officials around the world take this lockstep approach?
So there's two issues. The first is, to say that the vaccines are not safe or effective isn't quite accurate. Okay? In general, they appear to be reasonably safe for a large fraction of the people who take them. It's just that the fraction for whom they're not safe is too large compared to doing something among 300 million people, say, in the United States. You can't do something to 300 million people and have 30,000 or 50,000 or 100,000 seriously injured because they're healthy people to start with. You just don't do that because the cost of not doing that, of those people getting COVID would not have been nearly that bad. The people would not die in those numbers compared to what happened with the vaccine. So the cost-benefit analysis is bad, but that doesn't make them unsafe in a global engineering kind of public health conception. So, and effective, again, took over a year to recognize that their effectiveness wanes, that they were somewhat effective at the outset, but that more or less disappeared by January 1st of 2022. I wrote an essay for Brownstone saying that the emergency is over. Now that we've got Omicron, the emergency is over. And this is a respiratory viral disease like any other. It has a comparable mortality to the flu, which we take in stride as a society. We don't get exercised about the flu, you know, in a personal way. And if we as a society can take that in stride, even if the flu kills 30 or 40,000 people a year, we can take COVID, Omicron COVID, you know, in stride because it's at the same level or maybe even a little lower. And so that was obvious then. And nevertheless, we continued this charade of emergency through May 11th, and who knows how long going into the future, because we don't know how long the emergency use authorizations for the vaccines are going to continue. So we have these vaccines that worked for a little while. Eventually, we started saying the vaccines aren't working. It took CDC 8 months to come out and say the vaccines don't work for public health. They've agreed to that. That agreement is the prima facie case why the government has no interest in mandating vaccination for anyone, because if the CDC says that they don't prevent spread of the infection, that's the only state interest. Whether or not they make the infection milder, there's no state interest in that. That's a personal treatment choice. If you or I think I would get weaker COVID, milder COVID if I get vaccinated, that's my choice. If I want to take the risk of getting bad COVID if I get COVID, it's my personal choice, you know. I don't have a choice necessarily if my getting COVID causes you to get COVID. That's the government interest. But the government now says, CDC says on August 11th of last year, that that no longer applies, that the vaccines don't work for that. Okay, then the government has no interest. So where is the effectiveness of this? At that point, it becomes ineffective from a public health point of view. Now the problem is, what do public health administration people believe, and how do they operationalize their beliefs? So there's a large component of paternalism. I now call that lying. As we discussed, you know, in many of the sessions today, of the presenters at the meetings today, this paternalism is the idea that public health professionals are professional and know better than John Q. Public as to what behaviors they should do to protect themselves and the society. And so we'll tell them what they should do. And if they're not willing to listen to that, well, we'll manipulate them so they will listen to it. So we'll have inducements, and we'll give them a free beer or a free donut or whatever if they get vaccinated and so on. Well, that got egregious when they started belittling and demeaning, you know, unvaccinated people who had rational reasons choosing not to be vaccinated. That's demonization. That is no longer paternalism. Okay, so they crossed the edge, the border, from what I might consider benign paternalism, letting their professional opinions drive how they inform the public, to compelling the public to do behaviors that damaged the people who didn't do those behaviors. Okay, and so there's a problem there. Public health should never have gone to there. Public health needs to stay within what I'll call benign paternalism, or at least just stay within honesty. I mean, that if you're a scientist, you have to be honest.
So why did they take that path? Why do you think it is? Many, you know, through the FOI requests, found that in the 6 months post-marketing data, Pfizer knew that there were some more harms than, you know, there were more harms than risks. Why did the governments, why did Pfizer keep on with the, it almost became, some sounds like a marketing mantra, safe and effective. Why did they continue?
Well, the companies, the manufacturers, have an economic interest that they're trying to maximize. And as long as they can maximize it without putting themselves in legal jeopardy, and that legal jeopardy isn't what I would call a moral legal jeopardy, it's a technical legal jeopardy. What their attorneys are telling them, the laws that they have on their side, are requiring or not requiring of them. Once they decide that there's no legal jeopardy for doing something that maximizes their profits, they will do everything they can to maximize their profits. And I think the drug companies, the manufacturers, operate that way just automatically. Now, I would think at a point of decreasing returns, when you saturated a market with 90 or 95% of your uptake, it's not worth all the effort to try to pin it down to 100%, to try to push that last 5%, because the diminishing return takes more and more effort to get fewer and fewer percents at that point. It's not really worth it. So I don't know if that's the case or if there's some other reason that they were doing why they were trying to push down absolutely everybody they could possibly do. But of course, they kept developing new free markets. So for example, it first started with people over, what was it, over age 25, and then they started pushing into adolescents, and then over age 12, then over age 5, then over age 6 months. Each time they did that, it opened a new market, a fresh market, to try to get more consumers to take the vaccines in each of those markets until they became saturated. But of course, the childhood vaccine markets never got saturated, and so they kept up their messaging because they thought, you know, the messaging costs very little, and as long as you keep getting some new recruits, that the cost benefit of doing the messaging is effective, and so why not? They're just making more money. Freedom, they think, to be able to do this, and that's what they pushed ahead to do. They've been planning this for 30 years, and the pandemic was just an excuse, another plausibility excuse, that it's public health and we want to protect you. You know, and people buy into this because they're afraid. But it's not. And, you know, as people say stereotypically, freedom isn't free, that every generation has to fight to support the freedom that it inherited from its previous generations. And I think that most of my friends and acquaintances up to now have taken the freedom that we've had in the United States for granted. I certainly did. I certainly assumed that the United States was a free country because of all the blood and work and effort and brains of our founding forefathers, so to speak, that put together a country with checks and balances in the government to be able to make it a moderate democracy, you know, a Republican form of democracy, that kept it in the middle range of how a democratic society should operate. And now that we see that all of that is threatened, and we have to reassess the pain and effort it's going to take on our part to push back against that risk. Like, we have these laws. When the government operates outside the law, then we have to go to court over it. And if the courts won't, you know, operationalize what they're required to do, where are the checks and balances? You go to the media. Well, the media isn't covering that because they're corrupt also. Right? So it's going to take some time. But it will eventually implode, no matter what. That you cannot suppress a society of people who are chafing to get out and who are continuously working to get out of the tyranny. They will get out. It just takes time. All tyrannical societies have exploded eventually.
In my estimation, that tipping point will happen when we have enough of the public aware of what's happening. But there's such a great disinformation campaign. The Ministry of Truth calling experts like yourselves, bringing the real data, calling you the misinformation experts. How is it that people can wade through these waters? It's so difficult to try and have somebody take a look at the data objectively when they've had so much fear, you know, military-grade psychological operations, you know, thrown at them.
Well, it's not just lay people. We scientists have had the issue with scientific publications where journals either reject valid papers because they don't follow the normative messaging, the government messaging, or they eventually publish a paper. I had a paper I did a study with colleagues in Brazil on the efficacy of hydroxychloroquine in a very large 6 million member HMO in Brazil, showed very well, again the same thing, how well it works to prevent hospitalization. And the paper, after trying a couple journals, was accepted by a journal, and then it sat with the editor for 4 months before they would even tell us that they were going to put it in publication, which they eventually did. But, it, you know, I think they were sitting there kind of thinking, do we want to let this out or not, and what's our publisher going to do to us if we publish this, and so on. And then you have people like Pierre Corey, who publishes valid papers, and they get retracted, you know. And some of the other ivermectin papers, there's one that was published that was a valid paper, and then the journal retracted it, saying that some of the patients who were treated, a few of the patients who were treated, started their treatment before the Institutional Review Board, the IRB, had given final approval to the study. So that just invalidated the science. You know, this is nonsense. This is an excuse to take something out that you can't otherwise argue against because the science is strong. You know, and I've said all along that censorship only occurs when there's no defense. The people using censorship have no defense when it comes to debate. And so the only tool they have left is censoring. So when you see something is censored, is retracted, you know that it's true, and you know that the other side can't negate it by argument, by their own data, by their own discussion. And so that's what's been happening in the scientific literature. And that has pushed many papers into preprint servers. Preprint servers are web-based websites that house the papers themselves before they've gone through peer review. And for a year and a half, the preprint servers were more or less taking everything that was submitted to them. They have a big caveat saying, not peer-reviewed, read at your own risk, you know? And so we had to look at those in order to get the full range of what studies had been done. And then suddenly the preprint servers started rejecting papers without review, just saying, this is too hypothetical, or this is too unproven. We don't want to publish something that might jeopardize something about our existence without actually saying this is just not following close enough to the messaging that we've been threatened. Somebody's been threatening us, you know, even though we have no income and we're not really doing this on a publication model, just putting out papers as they come. They stopped doing that. And so that's when people started putting things on Substack. And so a lot of people write op-eds and personal essays on Substack, but there started to be data on Substack and so on. That basically people will put out their results, their scientific research, as best they can. But it also means for me as a scientist, as a consumer of data and of studies, that I have to go and try to make sense of a whole literature in a Wild West fashion by going to whatever source I can find and reading the paper and judging for myself as a scientist. So maybe we should take a pause here and then we can come back.
Here we take on the challenges of our generation so that we can preserve future generations. AmericaOutloud.com, 7 amazing years. We know that if America fails, the world will fail. It is incumbent upon us to carry the torch for liberty. America Out Loud Talk Radio, the liberty and justice for all.
Millions of Americans are needlessly suffering from the long-haul effects of the toxic spike protein. Dr. Peter McCullough and his team at The Wellness Company designed their spike support formula to counteract harmful spike protein from COVID-19 and vaccines so you can feel your best. Go to OutLoudCare.com today and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order.
Trouble getting to sleep and staying asleep is infuriating. Your mind races, you toss and turn. Nutrition company Healthy Cell created REM Sleep to help you quickly fall asleep, stay asleep, and sleep deep. Unlike other supplements that don't work, REM Sleep is not a pill. It's a gel you swallow with ultra-absorption of science-backed ingredients supporting all four stages of sleep. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order, risk-free. Love it or your money back. Guaranteed. HealthyCell.com. Code out loud.
If you're like me, you'd like life to return to some kind of normal. You're burned out on all the fear-mongering, but deep down you try and minimize viral exposure and your risk of getting sick. You've heard it talked about time and again by respected medical professionals. Use a povidone iodine nasal solution. I don't need to tell you just how powerful a nasal cleansing formula with xylitol, povidone iodine, and vitamin D3 for immune support could be. In fact, my attorney told me not to tell you. Google it and find out for yourself. Now, get yourself a bottle of American-made Cofix RX Nasal Solution. Let's get out and live again. CofixRx.com. That's CofixRx.com. Use coupon code OUTLOUD and get 20% off.
So we went quicker down this path, but I just wanted to get here because I like that you're talking about it. The speculation into, you know, it's amazing. Realistically, we're looking at a virus that was overhyped that they said would kill people, and they coerced people to take something that's actually killing them.
Well, it's true that the real risk was only in people with multiple comorbidities, chronic conditions like heart disease, history of cancer, kidney disease, having had a stroke or something like that. Those were people, or obesity and diabetes, those were people who were at high risk of a negative outcome, being hospitalized or dying from COVID, who needed the protection. They also tend to be elderly people, not all, but by and large. And so they're the ones who need vaccines.
Maybe. I screwed it up. You have 15 minutes left. That's why I was going to reverse.
Oh, I thought it was longer.
Yeah.
All right, well, Malcolm will have to figure it out.
Okay.
So
what do you want to do? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you went over.
Yeah.
All right, so just, where are we now?
14.
It's like, still going?
Yeah.
All right, so just wave to me at the time.
Okay, sorry about that.
Do you want to just start again from 17 minutes?
Just
so it's nice.
Sorry.
Okay, perfect, because. Some have described the world that we're living in now openly on Twitter as clown world. We have this mountains of data showing the inefficacy of the vaccines, the coercion that came along with it, the mountains of evidence showing that we could have stopped the pandemic in its tracks. We basically have a world now where one wouldn't think of this. It's like out of a movie. They sold a narrative to the public, scared the bejesus out of them, fearing a virus that was no worse than a flu.
Well, it might have been worse.
May
to
have
some
been
degree.
Worse. Yes.
Okay. Especially to high-risk people, to elderly people, people with chronic conditions, it probably was a bit worse. To everybody else, no.
Mm-hmm. But then we see them instead coercing something that is causing a severe degree of injuries, severe permanent injuries, as well as deaths that we've never seen before from a vaccine. Can you talk about that aspect of this? It just seems like such an unreal world that we're now living in.
So, I hate to say it, but I think there's a technical plausibility issue, which I keep harping on, that is very difficult to understand and easy to smear. And that is public health an engineering discipline or is it a medicine discipline? If it's an engineering discipline, my analogy is you build a bridge, and it's 99.9% safe, meaning one car in 1,000 goes over.
Sorry, I think we're going to just pull this one. Okay. Start. Yeah. Okay, three times lucky.
Wait, so you're going to have to put it back to 17 minutes.
Okay, 1 second.
You know how to do that?
Yeah.
The center button, well, it says if you start at a clock.
Okay, so you want exactly 17?
1740.
Okay, that's fine. Okay. Okay. Ready?
Yeah.
We're living in what seems a paradoxical and almost macabre world where we had the bejesus scared out of us for a new virus, a novel virus, that ended up being no more severe than the flu overall over 3 years. So people were coerced then into taking a novel treatment that has caused unprecedented numbers of permanent injuries and deaths that we've never seen before in any other medication. What's going on here?
Well, so the problem is we're conflating what is the idea of treatment with the idea of prevention. That in prevention, you start with healthy people, or by and large healthy people, and so anything that's hazardous has to be minuscule hazardous. That means the most vaccines that have been in widespread use, at least in Western countries, have been very, very safe. That doesn't mean zero adverse events, but it means pretty much very, very safe. Whereas if you're treating somebody, if you've got cancer or something like that, you're going to be willing to take a medication that might have a 10% mortality risk to the medication itself, because you're staring a risk like that in the face, in just continuing with trying to treat your disease. That's a huge difference. Now we come to this pandemic, and the question is, what's a good enough measure of efficacy and safety in this pandemic? And that depends on, well, how safe is the pandemic? How bad is the pandemic? What's the actual numerical quantitative mortality issue in this pandemic? So we knew within a month or two at the beginning of the pandemic that there was a thousandfold mortality difference between people over 80, say, and people under 10. And that's a gigantic difference. The risk doesn't really start until age over 60, and especially over age 70 when it starts to go up. Those are people who have chronic conditions like obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, history of cancer, immunocompromised, kidney disease, things like that. And so if the risk is so narrowly defined in those people, you don't need to be vaccinating everybody else as long as you can protect the elderly people. So here you have the Great Barrington Declaration that says, we don't need to be doing any of this stuff, we just need to protect the elderly and let everybody else get sick to develop herd immunity. Now, they didn't quite say just open the floodgates and whatever. They said protect the elderly, protect people at risk of serious adverse events. They unfortunately didn't describe how to protect the elderly, which they needed to do, and they could have said use early treatment, which was known then, but they didn't. In any event, that the idea that you have to vaccinate a whole country in order to protect your elderly people is not the right way to go about it. We never put the burden of prevention on children to protect old people. Never, as a society. That is not public health. We find other ways to protect the people who need protection. Whether it is that they're the ones who have to stay out of circulation and order from Amazon and get things delivered if necessary, whatever technical ways of doing protection, that's what you have to do for that. Now, I say, of course, use hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, steroids, whatever else you need to protect them if they get sick. Those things work in them perfectly well, not just in younger people. In fact, maybe better than in younger people. So this would have been the real management plan of the pandemic. But, of course, that wasn't sold because there was no fear campaign availability, and there was no test strategy of getting everybody to take the vaccine because we manipulated the whole climate to cause people to choose it, thinking that they're doing it on their own, which they weren't.
How do we reconcile, in 2009, they changed the definition of pandemic. They took out the words enormous numbers of infections and deaths to just a new outbreak. They changed the definition of vaccine. They took away a clinical symptomology, a case diagnosis for said disease, and they used the secondary tool, the PCR test, to become the primary tool, and then they upcycled and misused the PCR test, and therefore conflated all these cases where we had officials in the U.S. admitting you could have 3 weeks left with emphysema, but you got COVID through possibly this PCR test, and you will be marked a COVID death. Right. How do we reconcile this? It's a deliberate fear campaign of upcycling these numbers so that they could instill these pandemic protocols.
So that was either pathologic paternalism, or these people were useful idiots, the public health people were useful idiots, who believed that what they were doing was right in order to produce a vaccine uptake that they believed was right in spite of the data, that they had convinced themselves that this is the way out of the pandemic. For whatever reasons that they did this, they lacked critical thought, they lacked balance, they lacked moral sense, whatever it was that they did, they were true believers in this vaccine product. And true believers are not willing to see, let alone accept, counter evidence to their beliefs. That you can put the counter evidence right in front of them, and they'll say, they'll gaslight you and say, oh no, there's some other reason why that is the way it is. You know, 12-year-olds dying playing football, oh no, coincidence. You know, they had some other reason why they died and whatever. And that's been the mantra for the whole time, of gaslighting everything in order to maintain credibility of the message that the vaccines are safe and effective. Now, I want to get back to something that I've talked about, which is the difference between public health as an engineering discipline and medicine as an individual care discipline. In public health, well, say an engineer, say you build a bridge, and the bridge is 99.99% effective, meaning one car in 10,000 goes off the bridge rails into the river. Okay, is that good enough? Well, it depends on the context. So if 200 cars a day go over the bridge, very few cars are going to go into the river. And when one does, you'll say, coincidence, right? Because, you know, maybe the brakes failed, or maybe the driver fell asleep, or whatever. It's not the bridge's fault, right? And so you'll say, from an engineering point of view, anything that's 99.99% effective is a great job. You've succeeded wildly. But now, you have a tsunami over there, and 100 million people are trying to get away from that tsunami and have to cross this bridge. So what do you think is going to happen? Now you're going to have 10,000 cars piling up in the river. And is that okay or not? Well, 10,000 out of 100 million is still, or whatever the number is still a small number. So you're going to say the bridge is safe and effective. Gets people to the other side. Very, very few actually go off the edge. And so it's safe and effective. Yeah, but there's 10,000 people that who died off the stupid bridge, you know, who didn't have to if you had made a better bridge, right, or whatever. So the idea is that in medicine, you treat everybody uniquely, not a one-size-fits-all. You see what the patient is about, what they can tolerate, what their wishes are, what medications and treatments you have available to offer them. You work out between their sense and your expertise what's the best for them, and you proceed for that, and if it doesn't work, you adjust it and try again, and so on. That's how medicine works, not injection next. Medicine is not a one-size-fits-all. It's an individualized care system that optimizes what you can provide. And on that basis, it does much better than public health. Public health was stupid. Public health could have said, if you bring us evidence that you've had COVID, so show us an antibody test, show us a PCR test, whatever it is, bring us evidence you've had COVID, then we don't have to get vaccinated. And there was a discussion about this, you know, in the Virbac committee that licensed or gave the EUA recommendations to the FDA of my colleagues initially saying that maybe people who've had COVID only need the second vaccine, not the first one, for example. They got talked out of it. The FOIA documents show that they got talked out of it and went along with everybody should be vaccinated, no matter whether they've had COVID or not, on the basis of, well, just because they've had COVID, if they get vaccinated, they'll have even better immunity. But you have to realize that a vaccine mandate doesn't say if you've had COVID, you still have to get vaccinated because you have better immunity. It just says you have to get vaccinated to reach a minimal standard of immunity, a theoretical immunity, because the vaccines don't work that well, but a theoretical level. And just because you could get better doesn't mean you need to, because if you're having had COVID reaches that same threshold, you're off the hook from vaccination because you've already met that threshold. This was completely irrational thinking by my colleagues in that committee who went along with this idea that you could do better by vaccination, so let's make everybody get vaccinated, which is ridiculous because people who had COVID get vaccinated have higher risk of adverse reactions to them. So public health could have been rational. It could have said that, okay, bring us evidence of having had COVID, we'll stamp your vaccine card with the equivalent of having vaccinated, right? It never did that. Why not? Okay, because it had something else to gain by selling vaccines. Now, whether that was the vaccine manufacturers who were pushing these captive FDA and CDC, you know, agencies to do their bidding, that's possible, or some other reason, I don't know. I have to only speculate, but that seems to be what's happened, that the rationality of the whole program has been evident from the fact that there's been one size fits all and no subtlety and no appreciation that people can be immune without having been vaccinated.
And we've seen the Hippocratic Oath basically being thrown out. I know in Canada, I followed the doctors who have been suspended extensively and interviewed people who've had these vaccine injuries, and one lady was put into a wheelchair. After her second shot, she went to her public health unit and said, what should I do? And the doctor there said, take a booster. We've had other doctors that have legally, as they're supposed to do, as a physician, report adverse events. And rather than the adverse events being taken seriously, this one doctor's public health officer, chief public health officer, reported him to the College of Physicians and Surgeons that had him suspended eventually. We're seeing this perversion of medicine, all the pandemic protocols thrown out before, for these unscientific ones that have been replaced. It's an upside-down world that we're living in right now.
It is. It's a massive scale of corruption. And corruption is either by, as I said, people who are true believers, who think that they have to do everything they can to save the public, and if there's a cost, okay, we'll sweep that under the rug because the benefit is so much more important.
Can I ask you what you personally believe? This would just be conjecture and you know.
Believe as to?
As to why we're seeing such a incompetence or one path of useful idiots, as you said, or something that's been engineered. What are we really looking at here?
Well, I think it's really difficult to know. I think that Robert Malone said in our sessions yesterday, actually, that this is a controlled government operation that has tentacles all over the world, that some level of government in the United States government has something to gain by doing this, whether that's in collusion with the World Health Organization or not. I have no information to speculate on. So we don't know exactly who the puppet master is, but we know that there is a puppet master who's coordinating all of these consistent, coherent, and identical contemporaneous messaging all over the world. The same language, the same phrases, you know, the same slogans being used all over the world at the same time.
Smart cities being rolled out at the same time, everything coming out in lockstep, the policies, the travel bans, the vaccine mandates.
Well, they're not smart cities, they're stupid cities.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. I would agree. Going forward, how do we fix this broken system? Any thoughts on that?
So, one way that people have done this is, as in Europe, is have massive protest rallies in France and Italy and other places. Hundreds of thousands of people showing up in town squares, you know, chanting bullhorns and signs and all this. That's done nothing. Because the people in control of this think two things. One is, if the people are protesting, that means they're powerless. They haven't stopped us. The protests don't do anything because the media aren't even picking that up enough to matter. So we don't care. That just shows how weak they are, not how much we have to change because they're upset with us. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, if that doesn't work, all that's left is to say no. That means people have to, as I say, put sand in the gears. That everybody needs to stand up in their own personal space and say, no, I'm not willing to go along with this. and I have a plan B. Everybody needs to figure out what their plan B is so that when things like their livelihood gets threatened, they have a way around it. That is the crucial thing. And not everybody can do that, obviously. But people who can configure their circumstances in life to be able to know that if they lost their career, they have another career, they have another way of income, they have another way of supporting themselves, they have investments, they have a spouse, they have whatever, family, you know, resources. They have to be able to stand up and say no and in large enough numbers that it stops this from happening. So, for example, if a hospital says to the nurses, you have to be vaccinated or you're fired, the nurses have to say, I'm not being vaccinated. And if 25 or 30% of the nurses say that, then and the hospital fires them, the hospital comes to a standstill. Okay. And that's how it works. That in Canada, it was always work to rule, right? That when truckers, for example, before the recent truckers, when truckers needed to renegotiate their contracts, they didn't go on strike. They just slowed down. They had to drive at 40 miles an hour or whatever the minimum was. They would, instead of driving at 65 or 70, they drove at 40 or 45, which slowed down everything, which made it impractical and so on. And they felt the pressure, the economic pressure from doing that. But it was legal because that was part of their contracts, and that's how they managed it. So that is how, those are the kinds of methods that one uses, that you have to throw sand in the gears to bring the system, to slow it down, to make the pain on their side, not just on our side. And I think that's what people have to do.
Fantastic. Any parting words? I mean, as a leading epidemiologist, your insights go farther into these public health policies than most. Anything else you have to add to this conversation? Because it's been brilliant.
Well, thank you. You know, the times are dramatic, and it really does force people to confront what they're doing in life and what they expect to get out of life and their society. And for most people, they just want to live their normal kind of middle-class life, you know, with the pleasures that they have and their family and their hobbies and their work and so on, and their economic status. And they want to build up their economic status as best they can and pass it on to the next generation if they can, and things like that. That is how normal human life in the 20th and 21st centuries has worked and is supposed to work. And now that this has been interfered with, why would we just take it? You know, our forefathers, so to speak, in the American Revolution, didn't take it. They didn't take it from England. They stood up. There were plenty of British sympathizers in the United States at the time who said, well, we can live with taxation. You know, why should we interfere with that? And they said, no, it's our fundamental right to be free and to choose our own economic and social and political path. And that is the essence of modern life that we are losing, on the verge of losing. And that's what requires everybody to take a stand for themselves and feel that the onus is on them just like it's on everybody else. And I certainly feel that, and I hope everybody takes that to heart.
I truly believe that people are, the ones who are seeing what's happening, that are truly observing with a critical mind, are acutely aware of what democracy is and what freedom is. And I just want to thank you so much, Dr. Reich, for spending this time with us.
Thank you, and my pleasure.
Excellent.